Well, what do we have here? Another episode of Fish Fry? Okay. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this here electronic engineering podcast called Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by EEJournal.com and written, produced, and hosted by yours truly, Amelia Dalton. So what do I have cooked up for y'all this week? Well, my guest is Ted Chua from Cadence Design Systems, and we're talking about the what, why, and how of floating point DSPs. But first, it's time for a little news you may have missed. So, what if we could power our wearable devices with our own sweat? And what if that power could run on only 2 millimeters of sweat and run for 20 hours? And what if that same battery does not need charging and does not contain heavy metals? If you're a bit skeptical, I completely understand. But this is exactly the technology being developed at Nanyang Technological University, or NTU, in Singapore. So, the battery in question is currently in a prototype phase and measures only about 2 centimeters by 2 centimeters. And at the heart of this new sweat-powered battery are printed silver flake electrodes, which have been printed onto a stretchable textile. So, when these silver flakes come into contact with sweat, or artificial sweat, as in the case of this first prototype, its acidity and chloride ions actually cause those silver flakes to clump together, which increases their ability to conduct electricity and causes an electric current to flow between the electrodes. So what kind of power are we really talking about here? Well, this team at NTU in Singapore found that a person wearing this battery on their wrist while cycling on a stationary bicycle for 30 minutes was able to generate an output power of 3.9 megawatts and a voltage of 4.2 volts. And that was enough to power an off-the-shelf temperature sensor device, and also, very importantly, send the data continuously to a smartphone via Bluetooth. Okay, I'm hearing you loud and clear, my fish-frying audience. But what if I'm not sweating? Will this new stretchy battery even work? In fact, it will, because the textile in which it is printed on is so absorbent that it actually retains a lot of sweat. And since it only needs to function on a small amount of sweat, this battery can still have power up to 20 hours, even when sweating isn't as consistent as when you're, say, exercising or walking around in the hot sun. Now, durability is also an important aspect of any wearable design, right? Professor Li Poi-si, the dean of the NTU Graduate College, who also led this study, explains this aspect of their new device. Our device could be more durable than current technology. As we showed, it can withstand strain from a wearer's daily activities and repeated exposure to stress or sweat. The slim size of our battery also solves 2 problems in wearable tech. Traditional button batteries are a problem for achieving that sort of sleek aesthetics that are attractive to consumers, while thinner batteries reduce the item's ability to carry enough charge to last throughout the day. Another cool aspect of this research and NTU as a whole is their commitment to finding solutions to mitigate our impact on the environment. Now, this new stretchy, sweat-happy battery is actually part of their larger NTU 2025 strategic plan, which includes 4 grand challenges for humanity, including, like I said before, mitigating our impact on the environment, harnessing the science, art, and technology of learning, addressing technology's impact on humanity, and responding to the needs and challenges of healthy living and aging. Dr. Lu Jian,
A research fellow from NTU's School of Material Science and Engineering, who is the first co-author of this study, says this about this aspect of their design. Conventional batteries are cheaper and more common than ever before, but they are often built using unsustainable materials, which are harmful to the environment. They are also potentially harmful in wearable devices, where a broken battery could spill toxic fluids onto human skin. Our device could provide a real opportunity to do away with those toxic materials entirely. So yes, this technology is only in the prototype phase right now, but researchers at NTU are also taking a closer look at other components of human sweat, and also other factors like body heat that may affect the performance of the battery. Super cool, right? So, if you want even more information about NTU in Singapore, more information about this study, or even a video of it in action, I've included a couple links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com. All right, it's time to bring in Ted from Cadence Design Systems and talk all about floating point DSPs. Let's go. Hi, Ted. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Amelia, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Okay, so we're talking about floating point DSPs today, but before we get started, Ted, how prevalent are floating point numbers in engineering and technical calculations, and what types of applications require floating point calculations?
Amelia, if you look at the market today, floating point is very commonly used. We digitize the analog signal from the real world so that we can process the signals in digital domain. And those real world signal can be represented better in floating point format. All along, designer has been converting the floating point algorithm to fixed point because fixed point machine is easier to design and more readily available. But in the modern days today, floating point machine are also cost effective and has very high performance as well. Now, if we look at the market across the various market segment, floating point format is used in, for example, artificial intelligence and machine learning, automotive, robotics, drones, augmented reality and virtual reality devices. Those power and energy sensitive battery operated devices to high performance computing in data center. And those are just a few examples across the different market segments. Now, if we take a different perspective and look at the application, let's say if you are modeling a complex mathematical model on some signal processing modeling tool, and once you are satisfied with your mathematical model, you ask the tool to generate the code for your model. The modeling tool will generate code using floating point format. If we also look at some application that process large sets of data or sets of uncertain data or data sets that has wide dynamic range, and those are the data from the real world. And in that case, using floating point format for the processing become a requirement for those applications. And in some application, floating point format simply can do a better job compared to a fixed point algorithm. Some example is motor control application. Floating point can do a better job, better performance, higher degree of accuracy in terms of control, or smaller cut size. We can see floating point is really widely used in a broad spectrum of application and market segment.
Okay, so Ted, how do your new Tensilica floating point DSPs address the needs of today's designers developing highly competitive and differentiated products?
Given floating point is so widely used in a broad array of application, to really properly address the market needs, we need a highly scalable solution offering. And so Tensilica floating point DSP is specially designed to do just that. It can scale from very small and very low power 128-bit SIMD machine to very high performance 1024-bit SIMD machine. The scalability that TensorFlow Floating Point DSP offers allows the architect and designer to select the floating point DSP that best fit their PPA budget for their application. The TensorFlow Floating Point DSP has highly optimized PPA for floating point centric processing. That is very key in terms of allowing the designer and architect design something with high performance, low area, and low power. This floating point DSP also share a common instruction set architecture, and that allow the designer to really easily port their software across the different SIMD width of floating point DSP within that family, and also promote high degree of software usability. In addition to that, the floating point DSP also support N-Wave programming model. And that is very useful to help the developer easily port their code across different SIMD width. If the developer has a code for, say, 1024-bit SIMD width machine, and they decide to design something with a smaller, lower power, and need only lower performance, and they switch to, say, 512-bit machine, N-Wave programming model allowed them to effortlessly port their code to different SIMD width. And TensorFlow floating point DSP also support TensorFlow instruction extension. That allows the designer to further extend the instruction set architecture and create custom interfaces to further enhance the floating point DSP for their specific needs. And all those are very important consideration to enable the designer and the architect to develop highly competitive, innovative, and differentiated products.
Okay, so Ted, can you tell me a little bit about the PPA offered by these TensorFlow floating point DSPs?
Yes, PPA, performance, power, and area for the TensorFlow floating point DSP. When we designed and developed the TensorFlow floating point DSP, we were able to make improvements in many different aspects of the product. And as we go through the design development phase, we are observing improvement of various degree in PPA. For example, we are seeing the floating point DSP able to achieve higher maximum clock frequency. We were also able to improve the performance of the fuse multiply add engine in the floating point DSP by 25%. And fuse multiply accumulate engine is the key component in the floating point processing. In terms of area, we are also observing various degree of area saving, up to 40% smaller in area compared to similar class of fixed point DSP with the vector floating point unit. We are also observing lower power and lower energy in our floating point DSP to various degrees, up to 30% in energy saving as a result of low power and better performance of the DSP.
Okay, Ted, can you describe the software development environment that comes along with these floating point DSPs?
Thank you for that question, Emily. It is a very important one. It is very important to have a very good and high performance software development environment combined with very well-designed hardware. So for TensorFlow floating point DSP, we are delivering the DSP with a complete set of TensorFlow software tools that are common with all the other TensorFlow DSP. And the sets of software tools includes a compiler toolchain, cycle accurate and functional accurate simulator, and also other hardware modeling tools. And in the software toolchain, we have built-in features that help the developer build high-performance software easily. For example, we have a built-in auto-vectorization features, and that allow the developer to vectorize their scalar code with very minimal to no manual efforts and still achieve very high performance. We also support the LLVM vector data type for automatic and efficient SIMD scaling. As you can see, that is very important as we offer a family of floating point DSP with various SIMD width. We also have feature like instruction bundling to bundle multiple instruction to operate in one cycle to fully leverage the performance of very long instruction word, also called as VLIW architecture. Now, in addition to that software development tools, we also support highly optimized libraries. And these are the libraries that can help the developer develop high performance software quickly and reduce the time to market. These libraries, for example, are Eigen library, simultaneous localization and mapping library, and also the TensorFlow Nature DSP library, which are very rich sets of mathematical kernels. All this software offering that come with the Foreign Point DSP enables the developer easily develop and migrate their Foreign Point software to TensorFlow Foreign Point DSP.
All right, Ted. Well, I think it's about time for your off-the-cuff question. Since a lot of us have been in lockdown on some level or another, we can't have our favorite foods. So if you could have one thing right now, it doesn't matter if the restaurant is closed, you need a passport to get there, or it's on the other side of your state, what would you have?
Wow. I would have to say I'm very adventurous on food. I don't pick one food after another. I like to try many different types of food. The one that I like the most is spicy food. If I have to pick, I will go order takeout from some Sichuan or Hunan, very spicy food. And I have yet to find one that really satisfied my taste of hot and spicy.
I like it. Well, Ted, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Emilia, for having me. It has been a pleasure speaking with you.
Speaking of DSP, you should definitely check out a new series of articles written by my co-editor at EE Journal, Steve Liebsen, called A Brief History of Single Chip DSP, Part 1 and Part 2. And you can find these articles published earlier this week by checking out the front page of eejournal.com or by navigating to the article section of eejournal.com if you're listening to this a little later on. Also, before we go, don't forget to check out my brand new maker-themed monthly Fish Fry podcast called Makers Today. In our third episode of this series, I chat with EE Journal's own Max Maxfield about how he got involved in electronic engineering, what motivates him to create the awesome designs he has developed, and why one piece of advice from his mother made all the difference in his life. And we will have a brand new episode coming on September 23rd, and you absolutely don't want to miss this one. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EE Journal TFM. And don't forget, if you want to follow my personal Twitter account, check out Amelia D. 1978. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, you can follow us or me on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/EEJournal. It is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series hosted by yours truly. And you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can subscribe to this here podcast through Spotify, Podbean, or Apple Podcasts. And remember, if you'd like to further support this podcast, please leave me a review on that podcasting platform of your choice. Also, if you'd like further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology or heck, you just want to chat, shoot me a line at Amelia, that's A-M-E-L-I-A, at eejournal.com, or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of September 10th, 2021, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.